This is Power Athlete Radio. With your host, Denny K, Professor Booty, and the Luke Summers. And now, toes forward, hips locked, shoulders set, and retract those scapulars. It's time for some knowledge bombs.
Thanks for tuning in to Power Athlete Radio. This week, we are bringing you one of my favorite episodes to date. The Power Athlete crew chats candidly about a myriad of topics, but what separates this conversation from the typical HQ banter is that we took your questions in real time. That's right, when we made a call out on Instagram for an open Q&A, you responded. The topics range from kids in contact sports to diet to the professional foibles of your team's PT. In today's show, you'll hear the guys revisit a common theme throughout, and that is to struggle is to succeed. Everyone wants to win, and ultimately, it is the only outcome that matters, but a win is not a right, it's a privilege. A privilege extended only to those who put themselves in precarious situations, be it physical, mental, or both. Stay tuned because this fruitful discussion is guaranteed to resonate with your competitive side and serve as a reminder that as in life, nothing ventured, nothing gained. Life gains, sport gains, gains gains. This is episode 140.
Yo, what's happening, Power Athlete Nation? Welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio. This is Denny. Today I'm joined with John, Luke, and Tex, and we're going off the grid, right? We're going to give you a special show, and we're going to talk about contact sports. There's been some chatter on the forums. Tex, what exactly did we have that was posted up there?
So John, Luke, and I, Rob Wolf, we got tagged in a pretty good question. So the question goes as such. This question pertains to contact sports of all kinds, everything from heading a ball in soccer to NASCAR. Would you, the parent, allow your child or children to play a sport that possibly has head trauma? But we've learned many things from them, such as, you know, personality development, ability to work with others that have shaped us. So does that outweigh the risk and the concern about the head injury?
No. Mm. Well, that was a good show.
That was amazing. Okay, no. It's kind of an interesting deal. I think these questions are much more prevalent today, one, because we have more access through the internet, Facebook, all these different social media sites. So I think things start happening in real time, and you're seeing, this deal with concussions and NFL players and a lot of these problems. I think where parents need to kind of differentiate is the impact, I think, of, a kid playing high school football, I do not believe is dramatic as that as a collegiate or an NFL player. I mean, you're talking about, 200-pound athletes that are, basically running into each other and falling down, opposed from, 300-pound dudes using an 8-pound helmet like a weapon to try to, kill their person by weaponizing their body. But, it's kind of a weird deal and something I didn't really think I would have to enter in as I was a father of daughters. So I was like, oh, I'm not going to have to really mess with this. But now that I got a son on the way, I think it becomes more realistic. For me personally, I didn't start playing football until I was 14 years old. And, there was a comment in the forums today where somebody was kind of asking some questions about me especially. And he made a comment that, he thought that based on some of the things that I said that playing in the NFL was some goal that I had from the time I was, pre-14 years old, which it wasn't. I had really no aspirations to play in the NFL. I just wanted to actually play on the team, and it just so happened that I got a bunch of scholarship letters, and I realized when I got a scholarship offer that I could actually get a chance to get my school paid for, and that was really the extent of it. It wasn't until I got to college and the dudes I was playing against on my team ended up all getting drafted in the first round, and then it became a more real deal. But I digress. The impacts of playing football, I think, are minuscule in terms of what you develop in terms of a person. Long ago, I think I told somebody that the two best things I ever learned in this world came from my parents and playing football. I mean, in terms of like working with a team, you know, persevere, working, you know, win and loss, you know, defeat, victory, you know, how to, you know, glean some form of pride out of a defeat by, you know, realizing that you played the best of your ability and you played a great job. I mean, some of the best games I played in my entire career were actually games we lost. So, I mean, how is it that I could go out and play the game of my life and still lose the game? And it's like, you just kind of develop this stuff. But I think sporting, you know, sports has become this idea where, you know, people look at things so individualized that, oh, you know, an NFL player is having brain problems and the CTE and a lot of the issues which are very prevalent, but yet I'm not going to let my 14-year-old kid play because of what's happening down the road. So, I don't know. I just I think we've maybe lost a little bit or, you know, going too far down the rabbit hole. So the comment that I came back with was, you know, one of, you know, as a parent, I think you can only work with the information that is presented to you at the very time. And for me as a parent today, I wouldn't probably let my son play football until he was 14 years old after I had at least 2 years to craft him into the athlete that he needs to be to successfully survive that job if he wanted to ever play.
But that's so, that's also contact football.
Yeah. I don't even think I would let him play flag football.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many better sports that I think, you know, kids have opportunity to play. I think, you know, like something like, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I think would be great. I think, you know, boxing, I think, you know, and that was one of the, you know, things I did when I was younger. I did martial arts and boxing, and I think those skills were better. I think basketball, I think playing baseball. I mean, I think there's just so many things that help develop an athlete. You know, we've talked about it.
I mean, I guess you're also talking about developing the traits of an athlete versus what you got to earlier, which is what why I would be more of an advocate to get them involved, either whether it's whatever, honestly, whatever the kid wants to get into. But if it happens to be football, and I'm not a fucking parent, so this could all a nullified deal. But there's character traits that are built in a team sport environment, assuming you have a coach who values a team sport situation. Like, you know, like you said, mutual ownership of conflict instead of like finger pointing. I mean, all the fucking time in previous life, that was what we used to call it, the salute. Like, whenever someone fucked up, they would always point the finger.
Sure.
Versus, and those people were never athletes. But the athletes that I worked with that were team sport athletes, if something was fucked, it was like, well, let's unfuck it.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just like, I think that for me, that type of mentality came from...
From playing football when you were...
From playing football.
Well, what age did you start playing football?
10.
10?
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to play football, but I couldn't make the weight. I was too big. So, I mean, I think I was, 6'1", 165 when I was a freshman in high school.
Dude, I was on a fucking diet of broccoli, spray butter, and chicken breast because I was like 149, yet be 150.
Yeah, I don't think I could actually make the weight. And I remember I was like, but, you know, at the time, I didn't know shit about dieting. Like, I mean, like now I'd be like, hey, no problem, I'll make it. But, no, I didn't play. And so, you know, we just did a host of other sports. And I liked the combatives. I mean, I grew up with two brothers. I mean, we fought, we battled, and I think I enjoyed the combatives. I mean, even my four-year-old daughters, the other day when they came to the gym, my one daughter picked up a piece of foam that we use for bench press and proceeded to smash her sister in the face with it. And as my one little, as my one daughter went, goes down on her butt, she, like, looks around with this, like, you know, scared, I don't know what to do look. And she, like, looks at me. I'm like, pick something up and hit her with it. So she went and picked up a, like, a inflatable, you know, purple kind of, like, ball that we have and smashed her sister with it, and they started battling. But I think, like, if you have got to the point where you're an adult and you've never – and, like, it was great. I was awesome to see my four-year-old daughter have that look on her face. I'm like, great. Everybody should have that look. You get knocked down. What do you do? How do you get up? You have to persevere. The problem is I don't think we put people in a situation where they do get knocked down and they get that scared look on their face. And that's the one best thing I learned about football is, like, you get hit, you get knocked down, you get your ass beat. Like, you either have a choice to, like, walk off the field or get up and do it again. And I think that's what football teaches you more so than any other sport I've ever been around. And – you know, the big thing too is I don't think that people are preparing the kids for the demands of football like they were maybe 20, 30 years ago. I mean, I grew up with two older brothers, and I remember when I went to go play football, I was like, this is great. I finally get to battle against kids my own age. And I think we just, you know, maybe just not as hardy a person. I mean, you were the one that came home and told me after watching The Reverend, you were like, dude,
we are pussies.
We're pussies. ironically, as I went home and there was a deal I saw where this kid had tried to commit suicide because his mom would not upgrade the broadband. Mm-hmm. And their internet was slow, so he wasn't able to game and do things as fast as he wanted. And he's complained to his mom, and so he was so upset with the shame of it, he tried to commit suicide.
What sport does he
play? What the fuck?
No, I mean, but I like.
I know what you're saying.
No, I mean, what I think is really fucking telling, at least about, you know, this situation today. And Denny, you can relate to this a little bit. Like, I grew up in a time where, like, we came in and my mom was like, "Just leave, just go." We weren't allowed to watch TV. There was no video games. There was nothing. I mean, just go outside, ride your bikes, come back when it's dark.
Right. It was a punishment to stay in the house, right? Because they make you clean or something.
Well, my mom would make us cook and scream at us.
Right.
And so we would just be like, "Got our bikes, fucking go." So, I mean, like, even like when I got my daughters their bicycles for their birthday, and they were riding them, and, like, you know, about I think it was about a month ago, my one daughter asked, like, "What are these wheels back here?" I'm like, "They're training wheels." And she's like, "Oh, do we have to have them?" I'm like, "No, they're gone." So we took them off, and they, you know, can ride their bikes. But, dude, I remember the day my parents took off my training wheels, I literally rode away, and I don't think I came back for like an hour, and nobody came to look for me. And I remember I came back, and I was like, "Oh," came in, and my parents were like, "Oh, how'd it go? Did you figure it out?" I'm like, "Yeah, I fell a bunch of times, but I got it." Like, me, I'm out there on their, I got them a Razor scooter for Christmas. So what's awesome is they ride the bikes, and I've been kicking ass around on that Razor scooter. And, you know, so I go out and I ride with them. And they're pretty good, but it's not like all of a sudden, like, as a father today, if all of a sudden my 4-year-olds decided to ride down the street without me, I'd be like, whoa. I mean, it's just kind of a different time a little bit. And I don't know, maybe it's just us being different parents or however it fits. But I don't personally see a problem. Like, for my son, if he wants to play football, I'm not going to push him into it. But I'm surely going to arm him with the size, the strength, the skill, all the things that I know to prepare him. I think part of the problem we run into with a lot of things is we think that here's my child. I haven't done anything to prepare him for the demands and what's in front of him. And why doesn't he naturally get it? Isn't school going to develop? Like, if I had to depend on my high school for strength and conditioning, I would have never got where I was. If I hadn't been lucky enough to go over to Zangus's garage, I would have never really had the opportunity to do what I did. So I think as parents, you have to be proactive and be like, "Hey, if my son or daughter decides to play these sports, then, you know, I have to put them in the best position." I mean, actually, the one gnarly one is I take my girls to gymnastics, and we usually go early so we can watch actually like the older girls compete in gymnastics or do their training. And the training that these, and I think they're about 12 to 14-year-old girls, the training that these girls do on an everyday basis makes a games competitor CrossFit athlete look like a fucking amateur warm-up. Like, these girls are in there for 3 fucking hours sprinting, running, jumping. I mean, it's super impressive, and my daughters watch them. And, like, I watched a girl go off, and she vaulted, and, dude, straight up landed on her neck and shoulder and, like, fucked herself up. Dude, you know, they went over there, saw if she was okay, the girl was crying, walked her back, made her fucking go again. So, I mean, you know, I just don't think anybody benefits by hand-holding people to the finish line. And I think that's the one thing that I think sport really taught me is this idea that, you know, and there's a Talk to Me Johnny on that one I think I wrote about seriously, you know, was it Serious Muscle Seriously, where I told him, like, nobody's coming to save you. There's nobody hiding around the corner to fucking, you know, offer you this information and protect you and bring you along. Like, you're in a situation where it's you and your ability to do these things. And if you're not fucking proactive, nobody's coming to save you. And I think that's become this kind of, you know, needs to be more at the forefront. Like, you as a parent have to make your decision and say, "Hey, you know what, if I'm going to let them do it, this is the direction they're going. And, you know, if I choose or if they want to choose this, it's my job as a parent to arm them with either the skills or the technique." And I played with this guy, Andre Carter, who played at Cal with me, played about 14 years in the NFL and, you know, really, really talented defensive end. His dad was a coach, played in the NFL, and Reuben Carter was defense. He's still a defensive line coach in the NFL. And Andre didn't play football until his senior year of high school. He was a, you know, national ranked Taekwondo guy, did a bunch of other sports, Olympic lifted, I mean, super strong. And all of a sudden, 14 years old, decided, "Hey, I want to go play football." His dad takes him out there. About 45 minutes, shows him how to play some football. Kid goes out and gets a scholarship to Berkeley. He was there 3 years. I mean, first round draft pick. I mean, just a beast of a human. And, you know, there was a situation where I asked him, he's like, you know, I, I never wanted to push him to play football, but if he wanted to play football, I was going to make sure that all the skills that he needed to be successful were there for him. And, you know, it just so happened that the Taekwondo and the weightlifting and all the things he did made him ready.
So I guess there's kind of two veins to it, right? There's the selfish kind of mastermind vein. Like, I have a child, like we talked about creating the perfect young male, you know, teach him how to dance, teach him how to play guitar, sing fucking Dave Matthews Band, do a backflip and have abs. Like, you're getting laid every campfire.
Well, that was our goal is to basically arm your son with the ability to slay as much ass as possible by giving him a set of skills that will make him by far the best. Being like, oh, hey, this old thing, and just tears out and plays the guitar.
Obviously, as a parent, you want to see your child be as successful as possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, some parents take that to the extreme. I've coached youth sports, and, like, some parents you want to fucking punch in the mouth. But I guess what you're saying is if, you know, your son came up to you at 11 years old and obviously is going to be involved in all sorts of shit growing up to develop, you know, physically, mentally, and just, you know, the extracurriculars, and he's like, I want to play football. You wouldn't be concerned about the contact. What you would say is, okay, well, let's do what I know what to do. Let's get you a big, strong back, a big, strong neck. Let's teach you how to hit.
When you're
teach 14, you the fundamentals.
14 years old.
Yeah. But, like, if you saw that in the pipeline, then you would know there's contact sports ahead. So stay off the sugary drinks. Yeah. Like, they wouldn't even be on that shit anyways. But all the things that we know from all of our guests on this show and everybody who's worked with us, the things that perpetuate the seriousness of head trauma and TBI, you would just try to mitigate that as best you can.
Yes, right? 100%. You know, yeah. I mean, there was, you know, Dr. Perlmutter had a lot of great comments, but also talking with Dr. Ford, Ken Ford, you know, I mean, there's a definite, real, you know, kind of protocol to safeguarding these things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think through the ages, people have learned combatives for a reason,
mm-hmm.
because only through that type of adversity is it going to allow you to really know who you are. And
yeah.
I think, like,
I don't want to die without any scars.
Yeah,
Fight
I mean,
Club.
You start stripping that away from people, or we put them in virtual realities like Nate, where they just, you know, fist fight people on the internet with, you know, as a little character. I mean, if that's our reality, then I think, you know, Harry Stamper shouldn't have blown up the asteroid. And he should have let us hit him, you know, because the movie Armageddon was a documentary. It wasn't a movie.
Right.
Yeah. Harry Stamper. Tell him Harry's calling.
So, John, the story of you taking your girls early to gymnastics, that kind of reminds me of just growing up, because we start playing football at 7th grade. We start lifting once we start. Or you want to play football, you start lifting in 6th grade. So it was nothing but bench press, bicep curls, and just picking up dumbbells. But at the same time, it was that opportunity to see the other guys, the older guys, in the weight room, whether sure. they're in 8th grade. And then we were encouraged to go to the high school games. And so it was just seeing hard work. It was seeing brotherhood. It was seeing high fives and picking people up. So I was in the Katie Taylor neighborhood thing. So we saw a lot of losing. But at the same time, it was go watch these young men and learn from them. Learn from their mistakes. So when you are ready and when you have that opportunity, you can do something about it. So that's what I think is kind of missing now. People are looking at the injuries, they're looking at just kind of acute things versus the actual long-term thing of, you know, building a community, because that's all we know. So it's taken an interesting turn, and I'm working with some high schools now and just trying to change that from that direction of bet on yourself, bet on the guy next to you.
The state of which we're living in is people are reactive to everything. And like, there's no people are no longer proactive. Everything's reaction. Like, somebody writes something, they post on Facebook, and it causes a massive reaction. Somebody does something, and it's reactive. And the problem is, we become so desensitized to things that the only thing that causes a reaction are the most extreme things. So you hear all these parents that are, you know, like, I just remember when, what was it? Like, you remember, what college was it that had all those players get rhabdo?
Iowa,
where they made them, I think it was like 50 bodyweight back squats in like 20 minutes, mm-hmm. and then they had to like push a prowler. Like, and when we looked at the, like, and I remember reading the comments, and there was all these fucking,
how irresponsible.
Oh, dipshit fucking fathers. If that was me, I'd march down there and punch that fucking coach in the face And I'm like, first of all, you probably could make a fist because you can't make a fist with Cheeto stuff all over your hands. but I'm like listening to all these parents talk about it. This was my kid, and I only imagine if that workout happened and something bad happened to me, my parents blame me and be like, why weren't you ready for this? What did you do that this was – I mean, if the coaches put it out there – and we did way worse shit. And that's the funny part is I'm reading that being like, that's not bad.
That is literally every Monday morning for us.
Yeah. And – the shit we did in college and the training and the stuff we did with Roth, I mean, that shit paled by comparison. My only thing is it was irresponsible that the coaches – program something like that for a bunch of players who weren't fucking ready. So who failed them? Did the players fail them? Did the coaches fail them? I mean, it's like, hey, you can come out and like, hey, I'm going to load up that bar with 1,000 pounds. You're probably going to fucking die. Well, I don't know. I mean, did you prepare the person to squat 1,000 pounds? So all I read that as is not, I mean, those workouts were by no means bad. And I firmly believe that there's probably 400,000, housewives in CrossFit gyms right now that could easily squash that workout.
Yeah.
And I know because I owned them and I used to have soccer moms come in, drop their kids off, come in their minivan and crush workouts like that. But where I think is that, you know, somebody failed to prepare. And that's become this whole deal that, you know, I'm no longer going to be proactive with what I'm doing. I'm just going to be reactive. So I'm going to push everything out there. And if something bad happens, I'm going to react to it instead of being like, you know what? There's going to be mines out there, so you know what I need to do? I need to prepare you to walk the minefield, and I think that's the one thing my mom and dad did very well is they prepared us, and even when I went to college, I was, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, I had a offensive line coach named Tom Cable, and Tom Cable is by far, not only an impeccable coach, but an extremely, I guess you could say, hard taskmaster. And he put us to work. And I knew when I went to the NFL, there was nothing that I was going to do in the NFL that was as difficult as what I did in college. And that's a kind of a remarkable statement. And people, whenever I told people that, I'm like, they're like, how bad was college? I'm like, it was fucking terrible. We did a lot of hard stuff. I mean, a lot of people got injured. And it was just, he had a philosophy that, you know, if you got to make an omelet, you got to break some eggs. And, you know, there's a reason that doctors do surgery is to fix people. So he's like, you're going to get hurt, you know, and I, you know, my training partner blew a pack. I mean, we did, you know, a lot of stuff. And with that mentality, you just, you know, prepare. And I think what we're running into is a lot of people that aren't preparing their children or their people for the demands and the rigors ahead of them as they once were. So, I mean, it's like in today's age, I mean, Luke and I had this conversation yesterday talking about, you know, at what age do you introduce computers to your kids and you want to do this deal where, you know, in some of the reading and a lot of the books that I've read, there's a direct correlation between physical intelligence and mental intelligence up until the age of 6. So they did pretty extensive testing, and it was more beneficial to let kids go outside, run, play, you know, chew dirt and eat, you know, bugs and do all this stuff than it is to have them sitting at home watching Baby Einstein and trying to teach them computer programming at age 3 years old. So I think, like, I have this deal where, like, up until age of 6, it's all about, you know, physical play and this. And then at some point, as a responsible parent, you have to arm your child with the skills that they're going to need to be successful later in life. And it's a realization today that learning to computer program, being computer savvy, understanding, you know, coding and you know, all these other things that, you know, live on the web. I mean, that becomes a function of society. I mean, look at what we're doing right now. I mean, mm-hmm. So at some point you're like, all right, so you've done all this stuff in terms of gymnastics, working physical and this, now we got to develop this other stuff. And these are skills. It's like, parents that don't teach their kids second languages, you know, pick a language, teach them, you know, get a tutor, have them come in 1 or 2 days a week. And like, you know, part of the school that my girls go to is, they have, you know, 2 days a week of Spanish language. And then it's like 1 day of music. And that's like a varied curriculum. But, I mean, for me, I went out and my wife and I looked at these schools and said, hey, you know, this is important. And then, you know, at 6 years old, like we saw, there's like a week-long computer introduction thing for like five- and six-year-olds. Send them that. Let them have stuff. So, I mean, I think just like sports and hitting and doing all these things, you as a parent have to be proactive and arm your child with the skills they need to not only be successful but to survive the task.
So you talk about kind of mentality and physical skills. Transitioning from a football life into lacrosse at college, those athletes I went to school with, they never played football, they never lifted weights, And really, they didn't have kind of that physical swagger or comfortable being in contact. So I'd never seen that, and I had just it's all I knew was you take some hits, you get knocked down, you get back up, you push somebody down. And so I got into a lot of fights that first year, and then I was rewarded the opportunity to be team captain my sophomore year. And I'm not good at lacrosse. I was never good back then. It was just basically a linebacker with a stick. So to see all these guys actually go through that development from their freshman year to senior year, whether I was a part of the team or just a coach, and just seeing these guys go from this very preppy lifestyle into you actually have to work, you actually have to show up. I saw a lot of very talented individuals just fizzle out because they couldn't take the heat of a D3 sport. It's like, you got to be kidding me. That was easy compared to freaking two-a-days in August in Texas. So I don't know where the disconnect, whether it's you get farther away from Texas or what, but it's just funny to me.
Yeah. So I guess in closing, a lot of value just – but it's going to be a personal choice, and whether or not you're willing to prepare your kid for it, or if you trust the coaching and everything around a contact sport. But we have a couple questions through Instagram as well. So.
Oh, yeah, we got a bunch.
Yeah, and they're all really easy ones, you know, and we've answered them at length in the forums. But
which one do you want to start with, this running one?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to tack. I'm going to jump on it.
Jump on them.
So basically a question about, you know, if you're playing a sport that requires a lot of running, and I got another comment from him. He's talking about rugby. He said, is it counterintuitive to try and increase your squat or to even think that you will be able to work accurately with high reps based on your 1RM?
No.
Short answer is no. And when it comes to, like, you have to look at the training life cycle of the athlete in the sense that, okay, so you play rugby, regardless of how talented you are, if you're an amateur athlete in terms of weightlifting, what you need to do is establish base of strength. And we do that through our linear progression model, which we talk about at length, ad nauseum, on the forums and at the seminar. And after that, it's not necessarily about increasing your 1RMs because your 1RMs don't necessarily translate to on-field performance regardless of whether you're running or not. The 1RM, like what we're doing with the form collar and testing what is your true force output and being able to move heavy weights fast, and this goes back to Hatfield, episode 68 or 69 of radio, go listen to him. In the world of sport, there's only one universal truth, and is the idea that speed is king. And even though you're doing a lot of running in rugby, and Tex, I'm going to let you take over here because I'm starting to, you know, talk in your language here. It's not about the downtime of your sport. It's about the moment in sport where you either win the game or you lose the game. And can you accelerate at top speed, and can you maintain that top speed for the distances required of your sport? So the direct answer is just keep lifting heavy weights, but move the bar as fast as you can. Don't worry about increasing your 1RM. Get in, move the dirt. But Tex, I'll let you jump on this next, and then we'll let John close out.
Yeah, the only way to really truly understand everything Luke said is for you in one instant to be overpowered, out sprinted, just get your ass beat. Then you'll realize your 1RM doesn't mean shit.
That's it.
Well, I think he was asking about, you know, trying to, you know, is it counterintuitive to try to get stronger? And I would say if anything ever seems to be counterintuitive to strength, take a step back and realize that's wrong. The goal should be every time you walk in the weight room to increase your strength. I never got better at football in the weight room. I got stronger. I got more explosive. I got, you know, all these other key factors, all these skills that allowed me to go out and translate them onto the field. That's what kind of drives me a little crazy when I hear coaches talking about sports-specific training in the weight room. I'm like, well, does it involve a ball? Like, what does it involve? Like, you know, so it's just the people don't fucking know. Mm-hmm. Just that's the only way I can kind of equate it. And so I think as long as you are, you know, set a goal, and, you know, if it's bar speed, you know, compensatory acceleration, you know, whatever it looks like. But ideally, every time I walk into the weight room, my job is to increase my strength and create, as Luke said, a larger base of to work from.
And there's a thread here that we just take for granted, John, because I think we've lived in it, is posture position and execution of movement. And if you're moving the bar at all costs to lift as much weight as you can, then you're missing the point as well. The movement pattern should be resemblant of the positions you find yourself in sport, and that's our universal athletic position. Again, something we cover ad nauseum and in the seminar. And if you don't know what that means, you're an athlete, you need help, and you need our help. And we, as far as I know, of the big names out there, we're really the only one integrating that into the strength and conditioning component is a universal posture and position that will ensure improved athleticism on the field of sport.
And 1RMs they'll definitely paint a picture for you to show where you will fail on the field. So that's another good reason for them.
For sure. So hopefully we smash that one. Denny, you're looking for read the question, Denny, that you're seeing.
Well, some guy wants to know how much wood would Woodchuck chuck, or how much wood would Wellborn chuck if Wellborn could chuck wood? One.
But a real big one.
Yeah. This guy asks, when using a ketogenic or low carb diet, have you ever experienced really bad headaches? No.
But let's keep on that vein because there's another question. Walk through a week for people because John right now, so I guess explain the keto approach that you're doing, which you can find. We offered the exact template John's doing on the site under our nutrition templates. Yeah. But now put it into a food for these people.
All right. It's pretty basic. And I think people, because it's so basic, end up kind of fucking it up a little bit. We train early in the morning, so usually get here. I usually take some amino acids and put them in some water and drink them over the course of my training. Once I get home, like this morning, for example, I took a tablespoon of butter, had 4 eggs, 3 teaspoons of almond butter, and a piece of cheese. And for lunch, I have two 5 or 6 ounce portions of some crock pot roast. And I have a bunch of veggies, and I will actually supplement one of those meals with olive oil and maybe another one, some MCT oil. And then I'll have a snack that'll probably be some nuts, maybe some cheese. We'll go home and dinner, and it'll be some form of meat and some form of cruciferous vegetables. And I try to eat cruciferous vegetables at every single meal. And that's really just kind of hitting my macros, so I can really kind of get there in probably about, 3-4 meals with a snack somewhere in there. And pretty much eat that or some version of that with fat, protein, and cruciferous vegetables for 5 days. And then on the weekends, we usually flip the script and get up and train early on Saturday morning, come home, and I'll usually do either pancakes, oatmeal, and I'll flip the script and try to get a few thousand grams or few hundred grams of carbohydrates and kind of skim my meal. And I usually don't do a second carb day. I'll jump back on the keto on Sunday just because, and reading through Dr. DePasquale's book and just knowing myself, I can give myself about a full day of carbs, and then I start to smooth out too much, and I can notice all of a sudden I get bloat. So what I do is I eat carbs until I bloat, but what's hilarious is after I eat that initial carb meal, I'll take like 20 minutes and I always kind of go and kind of take the visual kind of deal. And I'll always, all of a sudden the veins come out and I actually look like I'm way leaner than I did that morning. And then I'll kind of eat carbs. And as long as I can still feel pretty warm and lean and still feel pretty good, I keep eating the carbs. And the minute that it kind of goes away and I start to kind of bloat out a little bit, I'm done. And I go on. I mean, I've had, that's happened in as little as 12 hours. And I think towards last year, towards the end of Jack Street, I was eating carbs for almost like 72 hours like that. So I would go home. I would work out on Friday, go home, and I would eat carbs all day Friday, all day Saturday, and all day Sunday. And it wouldn't be until Sunday night where I would start to bloat out, and then I would get back on the carbs or back on the keto. So I think, your energy expenditure, how lean you are, and how adapted you are really kind of drives that thing. So there's really nothing too jiggy about it. It's just basically being able to hit your protein macros, being able to supplement with enough fat. And then for me, I just eat free eat. I don't even count the number of, cruciferous vegetables, which could be kale, broccoli, asparagus, Brussels sprouts. I mean, really anything I can get that's green, kind of starchy veggies. And I just crush those all day.
So on that same nutrition topic, and I'm going to add a little context to the question. But do you think that Rich Froning eats as much bullshit, which I'm assuming is like the junk type food,
peanut butter jelly? What is Rich Froning eat that's bad?
I don't know. Danny, can you or text Google what Rich Froning eats? But let me just make, and I'll make a blanket statement here. Do you think he really does it, or is it kind of a stunt? And if so, how can he perform on the level eating crap? And let me, I guess, add a little context to this. Like, this is like if it fits my macros thing, or the guys who are the highest performers who eat like shit. This goes back to Willie Wiley, and then or Dr. Willie, and then just talk about some of the guys you've played with and what they ate.
Everybody gets wrapped around the axle on this stuff, and I think as your margin of error decreases, you have to start dialing in other things. Like if you are a pretty good athlete, you know, like for me, for example, I had a lot of good skills. Was I, you know, the most genetically gifted, you know, most skilled football player? No. So I had to, you know, not only train my ass off, I had, you know, make sure my supplements and my food and all the other little things were on point so that I could reduce my margin of error. I played with other dudes who pretty much ate whatever they want. I played with a guy that ate chicken McNuggets and drank Diet Cokes for every meal. I played with a lot of guys that could care less of what they ate. They just ate food, and I called it the seafood diet because they just, if they saw it, they ate it. And those guys went to Pro Bowls, were some of the greatest athletes you've ever seen, and were just physically gifted. Now, I don't know what Rich Froning necessarily eats.
So I'll read it to you from an interview, John. A lot of whole milk, a lot of peanut butter. He doesn't really pay attention, eats what he wants, and just listens to his body.
Yeah, that's, to me, that's a fine diet. I mean, if you like peanut butter, I don't have a problem with peanut butter, as long as you're not having some reaction to it. Whole milk, awesome, eat it up. I just think, you know, people have gotten so wrapped around this axle of, like, you know, trying to dial nutrition, it becomes this idea of, like, trying to reduce that margin of error. If Rich Froning's able to eat as he wants, and it, you know, I mean, for him, he's probably doing such a high workload of training that he probably just needs to consume some calories. I guarantee Rich probably eats what he wants. Rich is also pretty young. What's he, in his 20s? Like 25, 26 years old?
Yeah.
I'll tell you this. When I was 24, 25, 26 years old, I didn't really have to sleep. I trained twice a day. I could party. I could eat. I could do everything. And it didn't really affect me. All of a sudden, I turned 30, and I started having to, like, start paying attention to more things. And, like, as you get older. So I think the problem for a lot of you guys looking at this is, you know.
And just because it works for the great, and this goes across the board for everything, right? And when it comes to improving performance, because it works with the best people, doesn't mean it works with the bell curve.
Well, that's the.
He's definitely an outlier when it comes to this modality.
I would completely say that Rich Froning is an outlier for the fact that he won the World CrossFit Games 4 times. But you know what? I mean, he's an outlier for that mobility, because if it was universally applicable, he would have played in Major League Baseball, or he'd be playing in the NFL or doing something. So his ability to be able to persevere through a baton death march of events and compete in CrossFit, which is kind of a mixed modal deal, is probably better than anybody else on the planet right now. But has that applied to anything other than CrossFit? No, it hasn't.
So let me lob a softball at you, right? And this is, I think, a pertinent follow-up question. Do you think if he were to follow a quote-unquote dialed in, you know, food quality is paramount in balancing macros, and, you know, just like a nice, what we would subscribe to as a power athlete approach to eating, would he perform at the level he's performing at, if not better?
I would say yes, but who knows? I mean, maybe it's like a mental deal.
Could be.
Where, like, he's so absorbed in his own training and what he's doing that adding one thing, like all of a sudden becoming obsessive compulsive about, you know, macros of food and all these other things. Detracts from it. Other thing. I mean, the guy probably like, hey, man, I just trained 7 times today. Fuck it. I'm going to eat this pizza, which is, you know, is probably mentally, you know, relaxing for him.
I call it a food hug.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need a food hug.
Yeah. And like, you know, but the big thing is everybody loves to speculate on this shit. And like, nobody knows.
Yeah.
Like there were guys that, you know, like in the NFL where it was like, hey, man, are you performing? I don't care what you eat, just performance. And I think everybody is trying to do, I mean, like I saw there's old deal, like what is Rich doing, where people like are obsessed with what is Rich Froning doing. Mm-hmm. And being like, well, yeah, that's great, but you're not Rich Froning. So you got to figure out your own plan. And I think there's like this idea that, hey, if I can somehow mimic this guy, then I'll, no, it doesn't fucking work. Like, you know, even though we joke that everybody's the same decaying mountain and, you know, mm-hmm. you're not a beautiful, unique snowflake, everybody comes from a certain, you know, different, you know, genetic, you know, deal and a different adaptation. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that this is what this guy clicked. You know, if CrossFit had never been invented, you know, would we know Rich Froning as anything else? I don't know. Would he have, you know, I mean, who knows? You know, I mean, it's a good point. I mean, and if what if CrossFit goes away? All of a sudden, there's no more CrossFit. There's no more competitions. There's no more nothing. Are people going to stop doing this training? No.
I don't think so.
No, they're going to go back to the garage.
Right.
You know, and they're going to just selfie themselves.
It just has a name now, right?
They're just going to selfie themselves more with shirtless.
So I'm going to shift into a couple of soft, I think a couple lobs here. And I'll go. We'll go round table on this one. If you could only train twice a week, what lifts would you emphasize and how would your program change? So, Denny, I'm just going to throw you out there and I'm going to have you start, and then why don't we just go round table and we'll close with John.
I'd squat and press. Squat and press.
So, okay, day one, just break it into day one and day two for me.
Day one, I'd go in there, I'd warm up, and then I'd back squat and probably do some sort of like isometric like torso work. Day two, I'd go in, warm up, press heavy weights. I'd just do like fives, maybe triples, and just kind of rinse and repeat.
So, let's say realistically, you think an hour is a fair amount of time to train.
He didn't say that. He said twice a week. So I would have him do work up to a heavy squat, push, pull every day he walked in.
Yeah.
Just kind of like we did the Bulgarian stuff.
Conditioning.
And then. I mean, depends on what his goal is. Mm-hmm. If he wanted to condition, the next time he came in, I would actually have him do the same thing, but I'd have him do some like reps based off of the numbers that he got on that first day.
Yeah. So Denny, like the Denny approach would be like, hey, I got 40 fucking minutes. What do you want me to do twice a week? Kind of like the bare minimum. Tex, what would you do?
Easy. Intensity sprints, squats, day one. Throw in alternate bench press or overhead press or split jerk, just something, move some weight, press. Day two, I do either a lunge or a step up, and then just something fun and creative. Just find something I suck at, I can't do, go play some basketball, just be as creative as possible. So just sprint fast and do something I suck at.
I'm kind of like a mix between John and Denny in the sense I would squat both days,
yeah.
I would press both days, and then I would just rotate. Like the
you
final
would never
chunk.
Never deadlift.
No, absolutely not.
So Luke,
hang on, let me. These guys need to hear what I would do, and then
Luke
I would rotate
deadlift today.
And I guess I would rotate kind of like what Tex would say. I would do like I would go fucking attack my arms, occlusion arms on one day for the close, or I would do like maybe a fucking spicy lactic acid assault bike deal another day. Like that final 20 minutes, I would just make either a ball buster or something fun or something, but I would think I would break it out. Like basically you're looking at 20-minute blocks or, you know, maybe 10, 15-minute warm-up protocol, bang some weights, and then do something like a 15 to 20-minute finisher, just working through it 2 days a week all the way through. And now this actually – there's a question about this. So let me read this fucking question since it's a great – we call it a segue. Let's see. Stand by.
Are you looking for the deadlift question?
Yeah. Do you have it, Denny?
We got it. No, but we got to talk about that because I've been doing these strongman shows, and by far the weakest event is the fucking 18-inch deadlift, right? The axle bar is right 18 inches from the ground, and that position just fucking sucks for me, man. Like I've had to really – that's definitely a weakness of mine. I think I can pull – 500 for a few reps, but I can't pull 525 in a lot of these events. That's what it is.
So Denny, let me read this question real quick. Clint asks, in the past you you guys have made a post that deadlifts are like Viagra and should be used sparingly. What do you mean and why? How do I know how much is too much? What other exercises do you use to develop the hamstrings and posterior chain for performance? So let me talk about how much is too much.
All right.
Anything more than once a week? No, anything more than zero times a week is too much.
Okay. So where this philosophy comes from is old man Zangus, God rest his soul, believe the way you train your deadlift is in the squat rack by actually squatting heavy, and that the deadlift was like a pretty girl. you should ignore her at all costs. And so he was hilarious about it. So we squatted. I mean, we had these marathon squat workouts twice a week. And once they got done, he had preset weights on the bar. So there was like a 225, 315, 405, and then there was like a 540 bar. I think there was like four or five bars, and they were preset collars, like locked on. Like you couldn't change the weights. You can only add them. And he would like pull one, 225, one at 315, one at 405, and then he would pull the 540 for reps. And then as soon as it was done, day was fucking over. Mm-hmm. And so Zangus' deal was you build a deadlift by ignoring it. And, you know, there were things like, you know, back squat, we used to use a top squat, safety squat. I mean, reverse hypers. I mean, it was the sum of the parts is how you assemble the deadlift.
RDLs.
RDLs, dumbbell RDLs, rack pulls, shrugs, dips. You know, we used to do a bunch of heavy farmer's walks up and down his garage, driveway. And so, I mean, there was a lot of things we did. And I always asked him, and I'm like, well, why do you ignore the deadlift? And his thing was that the deadlift is so hard on the central nervous system that you can effectively overload it, which affects and fucks up all your training. Mm-hmm. You know, and he made a comment. He said Olympic lifters squat every day, but those guys don't deadlift very often. So the deadlift was part of just a strength check, just to kind of make sure everything was headed in the right direction and kind of move it. So from there, I think it was Dave Tate or Louis Simmons or something. We talked about central nervous system efficiency and the ability to recover post-heavy deadlift. You know, was up to 21 days for some athletes. So we just have used, you know, we deadlift once a day or once a week. I mean, and for even a professional, we pull heavy maybe once every couple of weeks. And, you know, in our grindstone stuff, it's rare that I end up going under 3 reps on the deadlift, you know, for the most part, just because, or I'm sorry, on Jack Street and even on the Field Strong, just because I know personally how physically taxing it is to pull singles on the deadlift.
And for posterior chain accessory work, you can step up correctly, you can lunge correctly, and you can really push your butt back into your hamstrings. So that's a big thing that people, that we've observed, people don't know how to lunge. They don't know how to step up.
And part of the reason is, you know, we've gotten so hyper-focused on this idea of hinging. The bilateral hip hinge is the, I mean, it's really our most dominant movement pattern and one that most people are emphasizing. I mean, a bilateral, you know, hinging is deadlifting, cleaning, squatting, you know, any type of pulling, you know, box jumping, kettlebell swing, kipping pull-ups. I mean, everything involves some form of this bilateral hinging. And all of a sudden you start, having people get onto one leg, move and, you know, lunge and step, and it fucks them up because it's outside of what they've normal pattern. And, you know, I mean, I remember arguing with Mark Ripto about this where he's like, lunges are fucking stupid. They just make people sore. And I'm like, yeah, why do you get sore? And we kind of argued. I'm like, because you're using a bunch of fucking muscles that you've never used in all the hinging. And I talked about hinging and he's like, it's fucking stupid. I'm like, why? You didn't think of it? And so Rip and I have argued about that for a long, long time. But, you know, you also have to remember his book's called Starting Strength. And, you know, there's a reason why, you know, we're not talking about weightlifters and we're talking about athletes and, you know, the ability to be on one leg and step and put one foot in front of the other. If you, like I always said, dude, if your programming just involves a back squat, it's an incomplete program. So,
John, what do you say when you hear things like people saying, like, if you improve your clean – pulling dynamically, that translates into like improving your deadlift? Like if you deadlift 500 and your clean's like half of that and you get better at pulling that faster and faster and faster, and they can, you know, and I've read the science, I've seen this argument, and it makes sense when you look at it like that. But then there's also something to be like if you've done a month straight of just like cleans at 250, when you go to pick up 500 pounds, it feels like fucking 500 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and part of that thing goes back to, you know, when Zhang has talked about the strength check, that you have to deadlift heavy to check your strength, to make sure your grip's fine, to put that load. The problem is, you know, anybody, it's like, I deadlift heavy 3 days a week. I mean, those people will fucking implode. But yet, you know, you have people like Travis Mash, who has his squat every day thing going right now, where those kids are absolutely fucking destroying it. But what are they doing? They're squatting heavy every day. You're watching him snatch, clean, and jerk. I haven't seen any of his, other than his powerlifting team, really deadlifting heavy. So, you know, and I know John Bros and those guys, you know, that squat you know, daily, three times a day. I know that they deadlift every so often just as a strength check, just to make sure nothing, you know, everything's fucking going in the right direction. And that's what George really called it. He was like, you know, we're going to build all of our lifts, you know, through the squat and, you know, different bars. You know, we used like a top squat, we used safety squat, I mean, all these different things. And then, you know what, sure enough, I mean, we did a shit ton of one arm dumbbell rows. I mean, that was another big favorite him, pull-ups. You know, there was a ton of accessory work. And then, you know what, you just go and you kind of assemble the parts. You go over there and check your strength and then hope, you know, everything kind of pans out. But one thing I'll tell you this, and as I'm sitting here looking at my hands, if we don't deadlift, like, I feel like my hands get fucking soft. Like, all of a sudden, like, when we pulled those deadlifts with that nasty-ass rogue knurled west side bar today, mm-hmm. like, my hands are burning. Like, I was driving home being like, fuck. And then and as soon as that happens, you know, I tell myself, we haven't fucking deadlifted enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we'll, you know, we do a lot of rack pulls. But for some reason, I mean, we did heavy barbell shrugs today, too. Like, rack pulls don't really tap me out the way that, like, a fucking low 4-inch deficit deadlift. Like, that is by far the worst fucking exercise ever invented on the planet. And I know if something sucks that bad and I hate it that much, I need more of it in my life.
And I'm going to jump on, I think, another lob here. John, I'm in the military following CrossFit football. If I was going to sub any of the Metcons during the week for a run, you know, like PT type stuff, what days of the week would you recommend?
Wednesday and Saturday.
Wednesday and Saturday. Easy one. And reason being, you got...
Just Wednesday and Saturday.
You got that free time throughout the week. Let's see. Was there anything else to that one? No. Boom. Okay, so now I'm going to jump on to the streety question here, guys. So, John, with a background in not only training while in the NFL, but also at the collegiate level, what do sports medicine staffs need to do better? Predominantly with regard to the transition of an athlete from a rehabilitative state to a performance state. How does the athletic training crew and strength and conditioning coach bridge the gap better between the distance that it occasionally does? The question is from being this question being from a more predominantly hands-on and progressive athletic trainer.
So the one thing that doctors and athletic trainers need to do is stay the fuck out of the weight room. I think more problems have been caused by a bunch of doctors that have never lifted weights and a bunch of fat, pudgy, overweight ATCs going in the weight room and trying to dictate technique and what an athlete should be doing. Case in point, I show up to Cal, and you know they took us through the physical and the whole deal, and I had a team doctor tell me that no athlete should ever squat below parallel, and actually told me that they were going to do some form of punishment if they saw me squat below parallel. I always had a real good, what you guys would, you know, call a, you know, real deep, nice squat, and instantly was told that I could not squat below parallel because it was going to be damaging to my knees by a fucking doctor. And it was propagated and supported by the athletic trainer. And I go back and I think to myself, why the fuck was a skinny doctor who has never fucking lifted weights, that only is propagating what somebody else told him, coming in the weight room over what our strength coach, who, you know, was a very competent, very good person. And so, you know, the other thing is I've rarely seen an athletic trainer that was in good physical shape. And yet those guys all went out and they realized, like, oh, hey, I can be an ATC, I also can get my CSCS, and now I can be a certified strength coach. And those guys should just stick to taping ankles and making sure that ice and stem is hooked up and get you a bag of ice and do a little bit of ultrasound. And really that's the extent of their knowledge with the modalities. To me, you know, I've had a lot of great trainers and just really good friends, you know, over the years. But the best trainers that I've ever been around were the ones that realized, like, hey, man, I'm an ATC, this is what I do. I need to make sure that I work with a really good strength coach that has his head out of his fucking ass. And you know what? I don't need to set a single foot in that place. And the worst strength coaches and the worst doctors that I've ever been around are the ones that think they know about strength conditioning and, more importantly, about human movement and understanding how the body works in terms of, like, athletic stuff. They have no fucking idea. I've gotten so much bad advice. Another case in point, I took a helmet to the shin in the opening game against Tennessee a bunch of years ago, and I broke my fibula clean in half. They casted me for about 5 days, and the doctor told me that the fibula is a non-weight-bearing bone that only supports 12% of the weight. So based on that, I should have no problem going back and playing. And 5 weeks later, I went out there with a broken leg that every time I took a step, I could feel the bones move. And ended up, the splintering of the effect ended up causing a pretty bad spasm, and I ended up rupturing my calf. And so if you guys ever see, or, you know, on I was on Mark Bell's thing, and his fucking YouTube douchebags were like, oh, look how small his calf is. Yeah, I fucking rolled it up like a Venetian blind. And the calf ruptured, and I came off. I pulled my sock out, and I was like, fuck, my calf is fucked up. And you know what the doctor said? Well, can you get up on your toes? And I was like, yeah. So I kind of got up on my tippy toes. He's like, you're fine. And so I went back out there and played at the end. They took off my sock. My whole fucking calf was all bruised up. And the doctor's like, well, we can put you in surgery. And he kind of went through it, or you can just fucking live with it. And I was like, you fucking piece of shit. You know, like, these problems, like, it, you know what it is? It's like, I think, you know, the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. But when you get into professional sports, it's like, protect your bank wallet or protect your fucking bank account. So the problem that I've seen, and what really happens in a lot of professional sports and college sports all over, is people, you know, people should know what they don't know. The problem is they don't know what they don't know. So you have a trainer that thinks he knows what he's doing, when his good job is making sure that I got good heel locks and to have a good ankle tape. And he goes in the weight room and wants to all of a sudden start dictating what athletes should be doing in the weight room. And it's completely fucked up. Or even worse, just have some fucking pencil neck doctor that has no fucking idea what he's doing going in there. So I personally have a lot of dislike for, you know, doctors and for trainers, just for the mere fact that, you know, I was around a lot of them that, you know, thought that they knew a hell of a lot more than they really did. And I played for, and I worked with some great ones that actually stayed in their lane, know exactly what they could fucking do and what they couldn't do, and let strength coaches go out there and, you know, help the athletes. So
stay in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, stay in your wheelhouse. But, you know, that's just like everything, man. And I tell these guys all the time, ego has killed more people than cancer. And when you get into professional sports, you have a head coach who has an ego. You got a head trainer that has an ego. You got all these people that all of a sudden think that they're out there curing cancer and fucking humanity, and don't realize that they're just part of the fucking circus for professional sports, which is basically entertainment. And they think they're out there doing something like fucking groundbreaking and being like, dude, let's fucking take a step back, unfuck yourself, and realize what you are and what you aren't. And I think people just aren't realistic with themselves. And so you know, for much of my NFL career, I didn't go in the training room other than to get my ankles taped and to get tape. And if there was an issue, I mean, I sprained an ankle real bad in Kansas City, and they had me in there doing fucking three times a day, either ice and stem and ultrasound. It didn't do anything. And one of the old docs who was there on game day, I saw him come in, and I knew he was a not only a doc, but he also had some horses and livestock and whatever. And I hit him up, and I was like, Doc, you're a you know, horse race guy? And he's like, oh, yeah, I got all these friends that are, you know, horse docs. I'm like, you got any DMSO? And he kind of shoots me this look. And he's like, yeah. I was like, because this ankle won't heal, and I need you to give me some DMSO. So he next day came back and brought me DMSO, and I had him put it on my ankle. And you should have seen the look on these young trainers' faces when all of a sudden this doctor's rubbing this cream, and they're like, what is this stuff? The fact that these young trainers had never heard of DMSO, he put it on my ankle, wrapped it up. Next day, swelling gone, played in the game. They thought this shit was witch doctor. And I looked at them and I was like, dude, you guys have all this fucking expensive equipment and it's fucking bullshit. And ice and stem, ultrasound, all that stuff is fucking horseshit. And I never went in the weight room. The only thing I go in there was for contrast baths to get some tape and do that. I went and I got chiropractic care because even though, you know, the fact that all the team docs and all the, you know, supposedly doctors think that chiros are witch doctors just makes me believe in them even more. Because, you know, when you're a doc and the only thing you can offer me is surgery or a pill, I think you're a fucking quack. So I'd go get chiropractic work, make sure I was in alignment. And, you know, there's a lot of charlatans, a lot of bad chiros out there, but I actually was with some pretty good ones, did a little bit of ART work. And for the most part, was pretty good. The only time that I got fucked up or when things went wrong is when I either had to go to the training room or I had some dipshit fucking ATC or doctor get involved in my training.
I'll tell you, one of the biggest faults I've seen just at the college level is communication. Athletic trainers, they tell the strength coach one thing, they tell the athlete another, and then the sport coach another thing. So then sport coach, I've seen it just destroy strength and conditioning relationships where the strength coach only believes the athletic trainer. He can do this, he can do that, versus what the strength coach is seeing. So just a loss of trust by failure to communicate, just clear, concise, and constructive information. And also seeing a jump towards the knife. So, John, I'm sure you're more experienced in terms of surgeries and injuries in that respect, but when a strength and conditioning budget is being cut because too many athletes are going and flying all over the place for surgery, I think that just actually a athletic trainer maybe going into the weight room or at least having a good conversation with a strength coach of how to freaking move can solve a lot of problems that exist.
I agree, man. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of lack of education and just a lot of lack of understanding of movement. You know, we look at things very, very basic and very simple. And when you take it a step back, I mean, can you do this? Can you do this? I mean, they had, when I was at Cal, the doctor who was our supposed team doctor was the GP who had done a like 1 year fellowship as an orthopedist. And so she was the one that would evaluate your injury, and she was the fucking worst. So bad so that when Cal asked me to donate later on, I told him I would only donate if she was no longer a part of the program because I saw not only so many misdiagnoses, but I saw so many fucking injuries gone unchecked. I fucked my shoulder up, and I went in there, and she checked it. She's like, you're fine. And I literally kept going in because my shoulder kept popping in and out, and she was like, basically was like, you need to toughen up. And I'm like, oh, this fucking lady. And so sure enough, I go in there or I see the orthopedist. I'm like, man, can you check my shoulder out? He's like, yeah, I think you have a torn labrum. And so he puts an MRI, and sure enough, my fucking labrum's torn, and they have to go in there, and they cleaned it up. And she was fucking pissed at me. And I was like, and I remember she was like, you know, that was fucking bull. I was like, hey, it's not my fault you're fucking incompetent. And you know what? Like, I'm really tired of this shit where, you know, all of a sudden, because you went to medical school and because you've gone down this road, you're all-knowing, you're infallible, you know everything, I'm this great, I have this DR in front of my name. And honestly, over the years, the minute you tell me you're a doctor, I'm like, eh. And it's because, you know, you are steeped in whatever knowledge was presented at that moment. And, you know, that's why, you know, I stopped going to doctors long ago, and I go and visit Tom Inkledon and different other people that are researchers that actually are on the cutting edge of this stuff. And, you know, I always laugh, you know, when people ask Tom, I'm like, Tom has a great clinic, and he has a ton of doctors that work with him that do exactly what he tells them to do. And it's because that's all they have. And so I had a terrible experience at Cal. I mean, the lady is the fucking worst. I hope she's still not there, but she probably is. And, you know, there was a lot of terrible misdiagnosis of injuries. There was a lot of players that you know, things got missed. Players got cut when they shouldn't have. I mean, just a lot of bad shit just because of incompetence. And I think, you know, that's because they're the biggest deal. And then you have people that, you know, want to safeguard and protect their little fiefdoms because of ego instead of being like, you know, hey, I'm going to, you know, because it's very hard for a lot of people to be like, maybe I'm not the best. Maybe I'm not the right person. Maybe there's somebody that knows something for me. And I mean, fuck, I was fucked up. And she's fucking motherfucking me about going overhead. And I'm like, well, you fucked it up. And now, and because I went and saw the doctor, you're fucking mad at me? Fuck you. And I think, like, that's the attitude. And the problem is a lot of athletes don't have it. I mean, I can still remember going in the weight room and the doctor coming in because somebody went and told him that I was squatting below parallel. I can't, and I fucking remember it, and they're like, no, no, and like the doctor gave me all these reasons, and I remember thinking, if our knees weren't designed to go into that position, then why didn't evolution just fucking make it not happen? Why, you know, why is it? You know, so now you're talking about partial range. I mean, it's fucking bullshit.
So I'm going to take us out to negative town, and we're going to...
Sorry, I get pissed off when I start talking about doctors and trainers. Fucking quacks of all quacks.
So our boy Joaquin.
If anybody that's a doctor or trainer listening to this, I'm really sorry, but fucking pull your heads out of your ass.
So to qualify, the doctors and trainers that you've been exposed to.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. I shouldn't make blanket claims like that.
So Joaquin hit us up, wants to know he's rehabbing a knee. Any tips? He's seen some videos with monster bands, and he's been doing some mobile, like K-Star, I'm assuming, because he's mobilizing. So kind of the supple leopard stuff. But what type of movement patterns would reinforce proper mechanics and strengthening of the knee? He's being diagnosed with jumper's knee.
All right, so jumper's knee is a common diagnosis for what's known as patellar tendonitis. So patellar tendonitis is where all of a sudden the patella, which is the tendon that runs on the front part of the knee that connects your quadriceps down to your lower leg, and there's a patella that sits underneath it. So that tendon, and if you reach and touch the front of your knee, I'm sure everybody here has at some point felt a hot patella. Jumper's knee is when that becomes overused. Jumper's knee is called jumper's knee because it happens from a lot of people that jump. The bigger thing and the bigger reason that we've seen where patellar tendonitis happens comes more from a weakening of the quad. So if the quad isn't firing or you're not able to activate and protect your quad, then all of a sudden you're going to have a lot of issues with it. So what we tend to do is we teach better mechanics. You know, for me, I would go up and see Dr. Bueller and have him do some of his muscle activation technique, aim it, and or hook up the Compex and do a bunch of EMS on that quad and get it to fire, which I think everybody should be doing in terms of recruiting motor units. So I think what happens with the deal is, you know, you can't protect yourself, so all of a sudden now you're eccentrically loading the knee, you're getting a bunch of patellar tendonitis, and then as it starts, all of a sudden patellar tendonitis is kind of like, you know, a Saturday at, you know, when Luke goes to the bar, it starts one drinks, he's having a good time, and next thing he's into this thing 30 drinks, and it's Tuesday, and you're in a fucking in a bad place. So the same thing with tendonitis. What you have to do is you have to take a big step back, and you have to let it calm down. You have to let all the inflammation and everything, and you can do that through ice. You can do it through taking some, you know, Aleve, just resting it and getting it down, and then you have to start back real slow, starting out with doing just some, you know, just basic isometric holds, some leg extensions, just trying to get that quad to fire, and then basically learning to not dump your knee so far over your toe, because I'm imagining a lot of people, especially listening to this, being Olympic lifters and in the CrossFit community, when they squat, especially, you know, doing a lot of Olympic movements, you're real upright, and the knees are really far over the toe. So if that knee gets really over the toe with a ton of loading, you're going to get some tendonitis, and it just becomes, you know, one of those deals where once it happens, it's more, you know, the frequency of it coming back and the availability of it coming back become even more, and it just kind of how it happens. So my deal is take a step back. The other key one is you can do some like terminal knee extensions just to kind of strengthen that quad. And you know, we've done stuff where you put on the Compex, get the VMO and the lateral sweep to fire, hook up and just do terminal knee extensions. I try to keep all of my movements close chained. What that means is foot pound on the floor. There's no better way to exasperate patellar tendonitis and jumper's knee than doing like leg extensions. And you know, doing a lot of lunging where your knee's real far over the toe, or real deep squats where you're, you know, shoving the knee far over the toe and kind of trying to bounce your butt off of your heels. So, you know, what you have to do is take a step back in your training and just really contain the tendonitis, get it to go away, and then slowly come back. So
but it's,
that's my
it's
deal.
Slowly coming back, but then also learning how to move properly. So there's this website, powerathletehq.com, and if you search plyometrics or ACL injury prevention, and we cover all those things. So it's just teaching you how to move properly, how to land properly, how to jump properly. So after the rest, once it kind of flares down, then this is your opportunity to re-educate your body how to move properly so it doesn't come back.
And you know what? I can kind of like relate a story with that. I'm working with a client now. She likes to run all these Spartan races, and when she came to me, she's like, yeah, you know, my knee, I got runner's knee. And she's like 25 years old. And I was like, man, you know, that you're too young to be having like that kind of issue, right? Like runner's knee is like PFPS, like the patellofemoral pain syndrome. And like some people think it's like it could be fixed with like biomechanical movement approach, or the other school of thought is just like weak quads and like these overly tight hamstrings and stuff like that. I just kind of started with like the biomechanical approach. I hadn't seen her run, but more I could tell just by watching her move that she could improve like her hamstring awareness. And John, after listening to you talking about like the Olympic lifting squatting, she had done that as well. She kept wanting to bounce everything, bounce in those squats, and the knees pitching real forward. So part of like her kind of the approach we took was really strengthening those hamstrings. You know, I only wanted her to squat just like an inch or two below parallel and keep her knees back. And then we did a lot of like single leg box work, just kind of like single leg lowers and trying to get that knee stable and really get that hamstring working to protect that. And she went and ran like a 30K a few weeks ago with really no kind of running prep, and didn't feel any of that pain. So I took that as like a good, we were going in the right direction, right? And just took that approach alone. And I thought of that as I was hearing, as I read this guy's question and hearing
Two things. One, years ago, I taught a seminar in Austin, Texas at CrossFit Central, and dude showed up there, and I remember he kind of came in. He had, we were rapping a little bit, big dude, big, pretty strong guy. And I remember, him coming over and rapping me a little bit, and he's like, I only came here to have you help me with my squat. I was like, what's wrong with your squat? He goes, man, I have the worst shooting pain like you've ever seen. And I'm like, why? I'm like, he's like, dude, it's terrible. We have all these issues. I'm getting all this fame. I've gone and worked with all these different people and nobody can cure it. I'm like, great, let's see it. So he puts on, and I knew it was bad when he threw on like a double, the patellar band. And the idea of a patellar band is it puts pressure on the patella. So kind of can kind of cut it in half and, help you a little bit. So he throws on two of these, patella straps. And I'm like, ooh, two patella straps. I'm like, let me see a rep and watch this guy. From a kind of squatted position, he doesn't push his hips back. He just falls straight down and bounces off of his calves, and he goes up. And I'm like, ooh. So he kind of keeps doing this. I'm like, we're gonna squat together. So I kind of getting close to him, like we're gonna like cha cha cha. And as he goes squat, I pull him back into me and get him to sit back. And as he's sitting back, all of a sudden his knee starts trailing back. And as he got to the very bottom, I like kind of kept pulling him, and he like barely could get out of the hole with 225. And he gets to the top, and I'm like, how'd that feel? He's like, I didn't have any knee pain, but I feel really weak. And I'm like, well, what are you doing? And I talked about driving into the quads in this. And so we basically, over the course of about five sets, fixed his squat, and the guy had no more knee pain. Fast forward like 3 years, I think we're at the CrossFit Games, and the guy walks over to the booth, and he was like, honestly, the best $795 I ever spent. He's like, that day squatting, I have not had any knee pain since then, and my knees are totally healthy. And I'm like, fucking helping people. And, and people ask me, like, well, how do you know about this? I had a ruptured patellar tendon. So talk to you a little bit about some fun. I tore my ACL in 1996. They pushed me back on my rehab too fast, and they took the middle third out of my patellar tendon. I developed really bad patellar tendonitis in my right knee, which obviously had been damaged during the surgery, but I also developed tendonitis in my left knee from coming back too fast in my rehab and favoring. So they did a bunch of different tricks to try to get the tendonitis. My right knee ended up healing up fine, but I could never get the tendonitis out of my left knee. So they got this new treatment called iontophoresis. And what it is it's a pad where they take dexamethasone, which is cortisone, and they put it in the pad, and then they put it over the skin, and then they hook it up to electrodes, and they soak in the dexamethasone to try to calm down the inflammation. They did this to my knee, I want to say like three or four times a week, maybe four or five times a week for like months, and finally it calmed down. I end up, having no problems. I go to the NFL. First game my NFL career, I ruptured my patellar tendon, and the doctor went in and he said, dude, your tendon looked like the tendon of an 80-year-old man. It splintered apart, had all these nodules. They cut it up. They had to put a ton of incisions into it just to get it to bleed, stitch it all up, got it all back together. And I remember talking to the doctor. He's like, man, would you know why your tendon looked that bad? And I was like, well, the only thing I could think of was this iontophoresis. And he's like, oh yeah, we use that. He's like, but we never do more than 9 treatments over the course of maybe 5 or 6 weeks. He's like, how often did you do it? I'm like, I did it like 4 or 5 times a week for months. And the doctor kind of looked and he's like, well, fucking hopefully this thing heals up. And I ended up healing up and never having any patellar tendonitis again. And at that point I realized what the problem was, how these to fix. And so I have not only had severe tendonitis, fixed it, ruptured a tendon, and had it stitched back together, and then came back to play another 9 years in the NFL. So I think in terms of like knee pain, knee injury, and battling through some stuff, I got probably more experience than any trainer or doctor out there doing that.
So Tex had to jump off, so I'll give him his. He asked me to ask him or say one liner. It's Joaquin, it's probably not what you're doing, but how you're doing it. And I think that's what it kind of all comes down to. The moral story of with John working with this guy on his squat, it's like, and it's not just getting hips below parallel and then standing the weight up. It's what happens in between. And that's everything we fucking preach. But I guess segue, similar subject. We got a question. What is the most overrated cue for the squat and the most underrated cue for the squat? In your opinion.
What would be the most under? Okay.
Oh, can I
Can I succinctly answer?
Yeah, the one that I mean, in terms of queuing, fuck. I mean, I
don't like. I guess I'm gonna qualify it with most misinterpreted cue is hips back, because that typically leads to a hip flick.
Yeah.
The most overused cue is knees out, and the most underrated cue is squat.
The one cue I always liked, which seemed to really is always makes people laugh, and so when we talk about like knees out, I think where people are fucked up is they actually try to drive the knees out, and where actually that knees out comes from is actually the hip and trying to spin the femur in the foot. So it's actually not knees out; it's trying to like drive the knees out. And the way we get people to cue it is I put my hands on the side of their knees and I try to collapse it, and I get them to spin from the femur, mm-hmm. and that becomes a better cue. And the other one is getting people to activate and squeeze their glutes. So the cue I always like is pretend there's a walnut in your butt cheeks and you're going to try to crack it. And all of a sudden when they screw their and they squeeze their butt, I think that does a lot of work. I think with the squat, I'm just trying to think of what cues people. I mean,
also quote unquote cueing a squat is kind of like, using pickup lines at a bar. Like, you can't just say there's one golden pickup line. You got to understand the situation, see what's going on. Right?
Well, especially for me in the squat, I like tactile cueing. Like, I like to actually like try to like put my hands on people, mm-hmm. which is similar to how you pick girls up at the bar. I realized long ago that actually a firm,
grab of the arm.
Grab of the arm and a grunt works better than like, hey, what's your sign? Like, so that, but the, like, yeah, the squat's one of those things where you would think that something as basic as just hinging down would cause so much problem. And I think the problem is coaches end up invariably throwing so many cues at people that it ends up fucking them up.
Yeah.
So confusing. I think you can over-cue the squat.
Anything else on that, Denny?
Oh, man. I'm right there with you on the knees out one. I mean, it should almost be like knees not in. If you're going to say anything, say that, right?
Because no valgus knees, right?
I've seen where, the valgus knee, you have to give that cue, and then I've seen where people don't even need to do it, and they do it because they've had other people just kind of like fucking drive that in their skull. So now they actually have a decent-looking squat, but they're purposely – as they descend, they're driving those knees out when they don't even need to do it anymore. So I kind of like the, knees not in, mm-hmm. And I like the idea, like what John says, of putting his hand there and trying to smash them together. Right. Like that's a good one.
And again, like there's within
and spread the floor. I've always liked that one. And I find that I use it more when I see people's like ankles kind of do like this inverse kind of thing, right? Like, okay, you can have tight ankles, but if I kind of mention that, like pretend like you're trying to spread the floor through like flat feet and all that, I bet they don't do that, right? Like they can keep their feet flat and actually everything looks pretty. If they keep doing it, then okay, you got super tight ankles. But I've always liked spread the floor for that reason.
And the whole cueing structure that we're going through is something we also like there's a system to it in terms of your mechanical cueing to your tactile cueing to your performance perspective cueing. And when you're training athletes, you need, if you're giving the same cue 3 years later, then you're doing something, your coaching isn't working. Cueing is a temporary fix. It's not something you should be hitting up all the time. So that's another thing on this, just the philosophy behind it that I think is overmissed or is overlooked, which is a frustrating thing. I know, because someone listening to this has probably been a fucking coach who has one of their like OG clients who is still doing the same shit wrong. And you're like, how can I fucking connect with this guy? But that's not a cueing problem. That's a culture and connection problem with you as a coach and your athlete, but that's a fucking bigger discussion.
No, it's like what Tech said that one time in that show where he's like, if you're going to stand there and all you have is like A, right? Like, and it's not working, you better have a B and a C to use. And it doesn't have to be an audio cue, something else, right? But
you can't.
You're just going to get frustrated. Your athlete's going to get frustrated, and then you're going to get nowhere, right?
Yeah.
So you better have like a B and a C in your tool belt.
So, John, I'm going to flip the switch here. In regards to you contracting with NSW, Naval Special Warfare, what did your work with the group consist of? And what kind of training template would you recommend for someone in that line of work in comparison to the power athlete template?
I went in as a performance consultant. So I would go in and do, you know, talks for NSW. You know, I did them everywhere from, you know, south. I mean, went up to, you know, obviously Virginia Beach, I mean, out to Hawaii and all over and everywhere in between. And the work was always about maximizing performance. So my deal, and obviously you guys know through Power Athlete, is a holistic approach. The idea of, you know, sleep, you know, make sure you're getting blood testing done. So we, you know what markers to look for, you know, what are you doing for your food? What are you doing for your supplements? What does your training look like? The big thing and the big misconception, and I was fortunate to go out on some training ops with those guys and be able to go out and actually, you know, work with those guys and see what the demands are, is, you know, this idea of sport specific. You know, I wouldn't train the guys from NSW anywhere any different than I would train the guys that walked in here to Power Athlete. They would lift weights, they would sprint, they would run, they would do all the things that we'd ask them to do, make sure they were strong and stable with their trunk, and, you know, basically prepare them for the demands. I was real fortunate to work with Andy Stumpf when he was injured, and obviously, you know, continually with Dave Brewer, who's one of the Chiefs for SEAL Team 4. And, you know, the training always looked like, how do we, you know, minimize exposure for injuries? How do we make sure they're strong and stable and fast? And at the end of the day, do they have the tools available to them to apply to their training? Now, there's no way for me to prepare those guys to all of a sudden put on a, you know, a 90 pound pack of rockets and hike for, you know, five clicks through, you know, a 12,000 feet elevation, and then be able to drop their stuff, run into the fight, get back, and then be able to, you know, get out on their exit. There's no way for me to mimic that training in here. So I'm not going to do it. What I'm going to do is make sure that my athletes are healthy, they're strong, they're stable, they're fast, and they have enough capacity to be able to have the ability to go into any situation and have applications. So, you know, and I just actually responded to a military guy the other day who asked a similar question. And my deal is, you know, what is your sport specific training look like? If your sport specific training looks like, you know, X, Y, and Z, then you know what? Don't try to replicate that in the weight room. I think what people really get lost in is this idea that the weight room is a one size fits all, that I can train for all these things within the confines. You can't. There's nothing in the weight room that's going to prepare you to go out and you know, hike five clicks in through the mountains. You know what's going to prepare you to hike five clicks through the mountains? Hiking five clicks through the mountains. Put on your pack, go out and take a 5-mile walk, however you got to do it, drag a sled, do whatever you need to do, take your dog out there and actually prepare. It's like, you know, the analogy always works for the military guys. I don't get to the range as often as I want, so I dry fire. You know, I you know, put in my holster, you know, inside the waistband, outside the waistband, whatever my rig, and I work on dry firing because I know that I don't have the ability to go to the range a couple times a week. It might be once a month at most, but I can at least dry fire 3 or 4 times a week and still be proficient in terms of, you know, the purchase on my gun, how I draw it out, push away all the different cues. But the minute that I go to the range and all of a sudden I mimic and I shoot, it's all of a sudden real practice. And I'm not trying to prepare myself for a gun battle with dry firing. So why would you prepare yourself for your job just in the weight room is a good analogy. But yeah, dry firing was extremely beneficial for me in terms of like trigger control and trigger management. And I got that from my buddies in NSW when I was learning to long range shoot. They talked about, you know, hey, I just want you to set up and, you know, just do dry firing to learn, you know, exactly where the creep is and, you know, hold your gun and be basically worry about it or, you know, worry on that trigger management, especially on the long range shooting, which is actually to me is, you know, really valuable skill set to have, but even the pistol stuff. So yes, I dry fire, I lift weights. When we do sport specific, we go out and we do it and head to the range and do those things. So that's just a good analogy for it.
So I guess in comparison to the Power Athlete template, it ultimately is, I mean, it's not that since you can't replicate one for one, the demands doesn't mean it should discourage you from training.
No.
It's lunge, step, squat, yeah. Be strong, be an efficient and safe mover.
Well, what people forget is the collegiate template for CrossFit football was written for Andy Stumpf. And when I had to go and do the, or when I was contracted to do the stuff with NSW, the template that I designed, and I have a talk, which is the talk I did for those guys. It's basically how to become bulletproof is really the talk. In it, it shows an early power athlete template very similar to what you guys see on Field Strong.
Yeah.
So imagine that. So technically, you could say CrossFit Football and Field Strong were first developed for a lot of our military athletes and then extrapolated out, because those were really the markets that forced me to have to think outside the box and offer something a little bit different.
So on the, I guess, programming vein here, we got a question from our buddy Josh. Fitness Genes, who, you know, we've tinkered with that. We found them to be pretty jiggy with what we do and giving you kind of indicative and parameters and propensities about training, diet, sleep, things like that. But they're now offering programs that pair with your testing. And he's curious, could or will Power Athlete have the ability to pair programming with Fitness Genes testing?
Yeah, Dan Reardon, who started Fitness Genes, good buddy of ours, when we came on board, asked us to help us develop his technology, a little bit of his understanding. And I actually wrote a four-week athletic training program for Fitness Genes based off of a bunch of different, predispositions that, when we sat down in his office and we started kind of, I guess we call them genotypes, mm-hmm. broke them into different, like, okay, what about this guy? What about this? What about this? And based off of all their kind of deals. And there was a certain set of, Adelaide's that if you kind of align them right, I was kind of able to be like, hey, just for these guys, what would you write? And I wrote a 4-day-a-week program for those guys. That's a 4-week deal with the idea that this would be a great introduction for people for athletic training. And at the end of that 4 weeks, they could transition to something like Field Strong.
Yeah.
So Field Strong is written for, obviously athletes, within a certain idea. But what I do is I kind of, knowing what I know about the different genes available and kind of, markers for strength and power and how everybody kind of works, there's just enough periodization to kind of universally apply to everybody. Mm-hmm. We work with, varied rep ranges. We, anything from 1 to 5 for more strength. I do more volume stuff. I push it out. I mean, there's definitely a very, I'm trying to write a more broad program to encompass more people. The only thing that's, I'm not going to really encompass in the program is if all of a sudden you're a super high volume guy that might need, 60 sets.
Right.
You just
can't throw that in the program.
Yeah. We can't pro it because, what I have to do is almost write to like the low to moderate intensity guy or volume guys, which might be, something that we can realistically get done in, 60, 70, 80 minutes, where all of a sudden there might be some people that have to drive adaptation a little bit farther out there. Which of those guys you're going to see, they're like, man, I started working out 3 times a day and the results got better. I mean, you just might be that guy. So the other thing too, and I think where people get a little confused on this is the genetic stuff's only going to give you about 50%. What that means is that's where you start. The gene, what you get in your stuff, that's 50%. The other 50% is what you've done with it since birth. So you might have, the Adelaide for, whatever the sprinter gene is, and you might be RR, which means you started with all, this really dope, gene profile that, should put you in the idea of being a real explosive athlete. But for the last 30 years, you've done absolutely nothing.
You're an endurance runner.
Nothing. You've just sat on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
So you've done nothing to express the gene, massage it, grow it, use it, just like anything with muscles in the body, if you don't use it, they become really not available to us. So even though you have that, genetic raw material or that potential, your ability to use it and express it over time is going to be the other 50%. So just because you had the Adelaide and you have this doesn't necessarily mean that all of a sudden you're a winner. I mean, like I remember Dan looking at my stuff and being like, oh, based on what I see with yours, you could say, okay, this makes a case for this guy being a professional athlete. There was also some weird stuff that he was like, wow, this is kind of odd. Like I had some weird endurance stuff that was really apparent. I was like, wow. So what you're saying is if I do some more aerobic capacity, kind of low end aerobic work, I can improve on a bunch of different stuff. And he said, yes, based on what we're seeing from your genes, that if you all of a sudden start paying a little bit more attention to some of, creating an aerobic base, that'll help you in other ways. And it has. So that was something that for years I fought and discarded. And I would literally when I taught the seminar, anybody that came to our early stuff, I was like, they're, you know, training in energy systems of ATP and glycolytic is all you have to do. Fuck the aerobic pathway. These pay back. So if you're strong on these, you can just muscle through aerobics. Fuck that shit. Developing aerobic pathway doesn't play forward. It doesn't do anything. And I learned the error of my ways. And actually, I learned through my own training that actually developing an aerobic base actually increased my strength and helped me be a more efficient athlete. And I wish I'd found that early on.
But not so, doing the aerobic alone. It's including
it. Including it. Whereas the idea of like the only – my deal was either I was running 100 miles as fast as I could, and the only cardio that I would ever do is walking from the facility to my car.
Mm-hmm.
Like I did zero aerobic work and I just thought it was stupid. I thought it didn't pay any dividend and there was nothing. And I wish I could go back in time and change that. And the fitness genes was very, very good about showing me that. And when I went and explored it, I was like, fuck man, that makes total sense. So it taught me something about myself that I didn't know.
So I guess to answer directly, cause it's kind of more my wheelhouse. Will we create a program that will pair everybody's fitness genes? No, but do all of our coaches, have we all got our fitness genes done? Do we all know how it works? Has John gone like full fucking bore on learning it? Yeah. So, you know, in the event that in a couple weeks or a month or so, we're going to be up and running on Train Heroic to be able to do private coaching. Could theoretically somebody say, hey, here's my fitness genes results. Here's what my genetic propensities are. Can you create me the proverbial custom tailored type of program for me based off of this and my lifestyle? Yeah. Like that shouldn't be a problem at all.
Sure.
Right. But that's not going to be something we're going to offer for everyone. You know, that's one-on-one, that's like private coaching service and that, you know, cost associated, but no, it's pretty, pretty jiggy stuff with the fitness genes. And if you haven't checked it out, give it a Google. It's really cool, really insightful on what's going on. So, John, I'm going to jump to two more questions because okay. One's pretty good segue. You were talking about just like, you know, what you've learned in terms of, okay, the aerobic work can provide a platform for me to improve in terms of my training. We got a question here. If you could roll back the clock, knowing what you know now, how would you change your training and lifestyle for football? Or would you have changed anything at all? Hashtag pirate life.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. If I could go back in time and go talk to the young John Wellborn, I could have helped him avoid a bunch of injuries. So oddly enough, the first bout I ever had with any tendonitis in my knee came from this idea. Like I joined the track team because I was going to throw the shot, but I also wanted to learn to sprint. And I remember we were running hurdles and I tripped on a hurdle. And as I tripped, I drove my knee straight into the ground and my knee like blew up. And I like, you know, and that was my first bout of tendonitis. We left there and we went in the weight room and I had this idea that, man, I had to get my squats in or I wasn't going to be able to like progress. And that kind of like day-to-day mentality was stupid. I should have been like, no, I'm not going to fucking do anything until my knee's better. And so I went in there and squatted through the pain. And that was really how the patellar tendonitis started in my left knee. And the other one is I was a senior in high school and my buddy, I went over to my buddy's house. We were up there. He had a tree fort. We were up in his tree house and we were throwing beer cans off of his top of his tree house. And as I came down, as I was climbing down, one of the rungs broke and it drove my right knee right in the ground. And that's how I tore my ACL. So hindsight, I shouldn't have run hurdles and I shouldn't have gone over to my buddy's house that night. And that would have stopped me.
But what about training style? Like, what did you do? So I know, like, you talk about doing all the heavy singles and shit in Zangus's garage.
Oh, yeah. Well, so when we were at Zangus's garage, we had these marathon squat workouts, and they were always, like, you know, pyramid up to a heavy single. And the other problem, too, is the guys I was training with were all real strong. And so all of a sudden, you're, like, looking around, and you're like, hey, what are those wrap things? And so, dude, we were, like, I was 14 years old. Like, I'd been squatting, like, 4 weeks. And like working up to singles and all of a sudden I'm throwing fucking knee wraps on. So stupid. Like and then coupling the knee wrap with like when I jam my knee up on the track and then went and squatted, all of a sudden my knee's all blown up and I'm fucking wrapping and basically pulling that tendon and that kneecap and driving it into the knee and fucked it up. So, I mean, the thing I did is I shouldn't have wrapped up as fast. I mean, I still, like, to this day, like, the thought of putting on knee wraps, like, makes me throw up. And anytime we put them on, I'm like such a little bitch about putting them on because I have such a negative feeling about them. But I think really doing that and also not understanding the physiology and working up to singles while I got stronger, I think if I could have done the linear progression like we had done, like we offer, you know, I mean, and I was a strong dude. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I squatted 600 before I was 20 and benched 500 before I was 22. You know, those were good lifts, but I firmly believe that I could have, you know, gotten there. I could have squatted 600 pounds before I left high school, and I definitely could have benched, you know, in the threes, if not better, coming out of high school. I think I just didn't understand loading. I didn't understand progression, and nobody really explained it to me. You know, we went in there and trained with George, and, you know, he would give us information, but I was 14 years old, 15 years old, which means I was a fucking moron. But, like, I wish somebody had handed me and been like, here you go. Here's this amateur progression. Don't ask any fucking questions. Don't do anything extra. And we were stupid, too. We used to lift weights at lunch. And then the guys I was lifting weights with were older, so they didn't have any fifth period, and then they had football at sixth period. So they were like, well, we lift weights at lunch, and I would always have to leave and go to fifth period after lunch. And they were like, well, you can't go anymore. And I was like, well, fuck, I think I have to. So I went into my counselor and was like, hey, how do I not have to go to my class fifth period? And the teacher was like, well, you could take zero period. I'm like, what's that? She's like, you start at seven. I was like, all right. So I enrolled and got my class switched and had zero period. So I would go to school from seven to, you know, zero period up till fourth. And then I would lift weights at lunch and fifth period. And then we would football. And then we would get in the car and my training partner would drive us to 24-hour fitness where we would do another workout. So we were effectively working out for like 2 hours playing football and then going and working out for another 2 hours. And it was stupid. It was too much. It was like all every kid we get, oh, you know, I want to do seven workouts. It's just fucking too much. And I think the problem is when you're that age, your attention and your understanding is only day to day and you can't see the bigger picture. I wish I had had a mentor or somebody, and Zangos was great, but we were dipshit kids. I wish he had like snapped me up by the nape of my neck and been like, hey, motherfucker, you're going to train 3-4 days a week. This is all you're going to do. And if I find out you're doing anything extra, I'm going to beat your ass. And, you know, and I think I could have progressed at a lot of weight, but, you know, good thing I made all these mistakes so that you guys don't have to. I feel like all the mistakes and injuries and all the problems and all the bullshit that I've dealt with was just preparation for all the information we give out to you guys. And more importantly for, you know, my kids and everybody around me. So, you know, I'm pretty opinionated with this stuff just because I've seen, you know, I've had to take my training and use it at a high level and I can see the mistakes I made in the past and I'm honest about it. And this is what I do and this is what I wouldn't do.
Solid. Based on your Talk to Me Johnny experience, what advice do you have for aspiring writers that want to inform the web readers?
Oh, Jesus.
Don't
do this.
Just keep your words to yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing that I've, anybody that's come, you know, and would Talk to Me, Johnny, I mean, so I don't know if you guys know this, but I was a rhetoric major in college, which was like an English philosophy with an argumentative approach at Berkeley. And I had aspirations of going to law school. And there was an old law professor, had been an old attorney, a guy named Adrian Cragen. And I got to meet with him and he was kind of a mentor for me. And we talked about, you know, when I was a young guy, you know, my goal is to go to law school and be an attorney. And he said, you know, my only advice is to learn to read and write to the best of your ability. And there just so happens to be a major here at Berkeley called rhetoric, which would be tailored for you. And that's how I got into be a rhetoric major. And then I went on and did my master's work in education, but the one strong suit I always had was reading and writing. And when I crafted Talk to Me, Johnny, there needed to be a voice. And that's something that, you know, and we have, you know, various writers and coaches and people that do stuff with Power Athlete, and I always get to read their information. And the one thing that I always look for is the development of their voice. And when I say voice, like, what's the angle? What's the perception? If I read 5 articles, do I know who wrote each one based on the ethos that they've created and kind of their, you know, vernacular and how they phrase things and what they really do? And they're literally like writing nuances. And, you know, when somebody starts, I think it's difficult, but then over time, I mean, case in point, I can think of Tex and Callie, you know, Callie really developed a very funny, voice and a very funny sense of humor when she wrote, you know, Tex is the same thing. So, I mean, ability to create that takes time. Like, nobody comes out of the box and just instantly has that stuff. I mean, I have, you know, years of writing experience. And so when I wrote Talk to Me, Johnny, I knew the voice that I wanted, and had the opportunity just to be able to basically write it. And so with a lot of young writers and people that come out, it takes time to develop. And the only way you develop it is just by writing, just by doing it, writing it, coming up, or, you know, being intelligent enough to sit down and say, what do I want to project? You know, what's the idea? What's the image? You know, what's the voice that I'm trying to grasp? And with Talk to Me, Johnny, the voice was just one of just very, too, you know, funny sense of humor, very, you know, trying to be very, you know, cutting and witty, which is, you know, pretty much what we do all the day. But I think, you know, I've met a lot of people that were real funny, very witty, but not so with their writing. Mm-hmm. And I've met people that were terribly, unexciting, that were incredible writers. So I think being able to portray your personality. And the other thing, too, and I know this sounds ironic with writing, honesty. You know, in a world where we're living within, you know, the confines of the world that we create, the ability to be honest, I think, will always have an audience. I read so much on the internet that's just blatant hand jobs, like fucking HJs of the most magna proportion. And I think when you read something that's honest and true, people gravitates towards it. And, you know, the way that I know that my writing is actually truthful is the amount of butthurt that it causes. If I write something and nobody's butthurt and I don't get a negative comment or that guy's a fucking asshole, then obviously I wasn't either honest enough or I wasn't picking a topic that was, you know, making people think. You know, case in point, like my 43 things I learned or that other one, that Seriously Muscle one. I had some guy in there the other day be like, this guy's a fucking asshole. Perfect. That's exactly what people need. Because you know what? Like nobody ever got better from fucking sugarcoating. Nobody ever took free positive advice. You know, you're doing great. Keep going, kid. No, nobody fucking takes that. Mm-hmm. You never learn shit in the face of that stuff.
Yeah, that conflict crafts character. Yeah. You know, like.
But in today's world, everybody has to fucking get a pat on the back, and we have to, you know. And I honestly think it's bullshit because it's this idea of like, oh, we have to help and this, and I'm like, dude, like that's non-representative of the real world. You know, like you have to, you know, if everything is fucking handed to you on a silver platter, what do you ever learn? Where's the struggle? Where's the perseverance? Where's the failure? Where's the knockdown? If you never fucking have that, I mean, character comes from adversity. And like, if there's never been any adversity, and this is a stupid analogy, but I, back in my previous life, when I played in the NFL, I used to roll with some fucking big dogs. And I used to roll with these billionaire dudes. And, their dad was a billionaire. And these guys had like, you know, $150 million expense accounts to basically fuck off and do whatever they wanted, private jets, the whole deal. And I remember, they had no perception of food. So like we would go out to dinner, we'd go places, and it didn't matter if it was fucking Pink's on Melrose or, you know, Benihana, or, you know, you're eating at the nicest restaurant in Vegas, which, you know, we ate at some really nice restaurants, because every meal was like a, you know, they had a private chef when they were growing up and this, I mean, they had no perception of what was good and bad.
They had no appreciation.
They had no appreciation. So like to know really what a good meal is, you've had to have some shit meals. Like, I mean, we ate fucking hamburgers and rice when I was growing up for most meals. I mean, like, dude, like I get a nice steak and like I take a second and I'm like, man, this is beautiful. Or like, you know, go out to dinner and have an amazing bottle of wine. Dude, I've drank some really crappy stuff, as I'm sure Luke has. I mean, we've drank Malort's. but you know, that appreciation of something nicer. I mean, like if your first car was a Bentley and you've never had anything less than a Lamborghini, like, do you really have an appreciation for it? Like, I, you know, drove a piece of shit car. Like, you know, I had a $300 motorcycle. Like, you know, all these things, like, add appreciation. I mean, you know, my first fucking house was, you know, so it's like, I always think that, like, you have to have some frame of reference. And the thing that ended up kind of smoking me on these dudes and why I just never kicked it with them anymore was they had no perception of reality. Like they had no, there was never any struggle there. Everything was given to them. They had no perception of reality. And because that, they valued nothing, they appreciated nothing, and nothing was of interest. And it was extremely just weirdly superficial. And I never wanted to be around that. And, you know, I always had friends that be like, oh, I want to make $1 billion. I'm like, not me. Because when you make $1 billion, you have to hang out with fucking rich people. And it's fucking difficult. But, you know, I mean, you meet some really, really rich people, like, I mean, or some very, very successful people, like, you know, Bill Bradley, for example, or different people that are fucking salt of the earth, that are as real as they get, because you know what? They started somewhere and they struggled, and they fought, and they value everything they have, and they earn it every day. And it's not necessarily the money. It's actually the, you know, just a way of keeping score and showing about how much they grind. And to me, like, those are the people I want to be around. I don't want to be around some fucking silver spoon, rich fucking billionaires, kids who are just, you know, fucking subhuman in terms of, you know, their appreciation for the for things in life.
Yeah. Who can't acknowledge or realize or overcome conflict, you know, like when conflict, people either shut down or run from it or ignore it, like tackle it. Let's face it head on. Let's see what's up, you know? And then I'm going to jump to the final question. This is like a little 2-hour gig.
Fuck.
So this dude, Kevin, is a boxer. All right. Recently his sparring partner, best friend, died in the ring during a match against this champion boxer from Russia.
Jesus.
So he challenged the Russian to a boxing match and intends to win. Should he go to Russia, then do endless calisthenics, snow running, log chopping, and dragon flags to a montage of training songs?
Yes.
Okay.
What you got to do is you got to find a barn in Siberia, right? And and actually have the jacket that you need. It's a bomber jacket with leather, and it's got fur on the inside, and I actually bought it for that specific purpose.
What about any sort of hat?
You do, yeah. You need like a knit cap, okay. And you have to run in the snow. You have to lift a sled, and you have to find a big sack full of rocks.
Okay.
You usually need like a really old boxing trainer, preferably like an old black dude from Venice, California, and you got to find him, and you got to bring him with you. And he's got to be your hype man. You got to be ready. And you grow a beard, and then you shave it when you're ready.
Beautiful.
That's it.
Denny, any advice?
That's just a beautiful image right there. Do you run to the top of the mountain?
Oh, yeah. And then you're like, oh, and you have to scream whoever this, you know, the boxer that killed your buddy, you have to scream his name from the top of that Siberian.
I think that kind of is like the pinnacle. Once you get that, you're complete.
I feel like we have to go watch that training montage. As soon as we hang up, we're putting on that training montage during lunch because I'm fucking jonesing for my crock pot meal.
Awesome, dude. Well, we tackled basically a bunch of questions. There's one or two that just didn't have enough info, but no, solid show.
Cool. All right, thank you.
All right, guys.
Thanks.
Later.
Later.
Now it's time for you to empower your performance. That just about does it for this week's episode of Power Athlete Radio. If you'd like to take a gander at the original questions asked by our live audience, check us out on Instagram @PowerAthleteHQ. Until next time, bye!